You may proceed. Ms. Kiernan?
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. Mr. Davis timely filed this suit 28 days after prosecutors dropped his felony charge for destroying evidence by swallowing a controlled substance. The district court made two key errors in dismissing as untimely claims related to that charge. First, it applied the wrong timing rules. As the Supreme Court explained in McDonough, claims challenging a formal charge don't accrue until that charge is favorably terminated. So Mr. Davis's claims related to the felony evidence destruction charge didn't accrue until the state dropped it. Second, the district court wrongly concluded that the dropped felony charge didn't terminate in Mr. Davis's favor. In Thompson, the court held that a charge terminates favorably when it ends without a conviction. And that's what happened here. The fact that Mr. Davis pleaded to a different charge under a different statute with different elements based on different conduct, walking two steps away from an officer, doesn't affect whether the evidence destruction charge ended in his favor. The Supreme Court was clear in Chiaverini. Claims like these must be evaluated charge by charge. Because there's no dispute that the charge of evidence destruction ended without conviction, the court should vacate the dismissals of claims related to that charge and remand for further proceedings. I welcome the court's questions.
So can you walk us through each claim and when you think it accrued?
Yes, Your Honor. So Mr. Davis initially brought some excessive force and arrest claims.
False arrest, yes.
Mm-hmm. Excessive force and false arrest claims, and he is no longer challenging those claims on appeal because they did accrue at the time that he...
Excessive and false arrest are gone.
Yes,
excessive
yes,
force and false arrest are gone, and you acknowledge that.
Yes, okay. Your Honor. However, his claims related to once he was indicted and under legal process, all of those claims, they couldn't accrue under McDonough until he received a favorable termination.
And which are those claims? Can you specifically articulate what those particular claims are so we can know what they are?
Yes, Your Honor. So there's a claim, there's claims under the Fourth Amendment for fabricated evidence. There's claims under the Fourth Amendment for seizure without probable cause. Claims under the Fourth Amendment for search without probable cause. There's likely also 14th Amendment claims here for violation of due process and malicious prosecution, of course.
Okay.
And so under McDonough, none of those claims could accrue until the felony evidence charge was dropped.
What do we do about the part problem that Davis's nolo contendere agreement, unlike some nolo agreements, actually included a confession that he acted with criminal negligence and interrupted a peace officer during the consensual search of his vehicle?
So that confession is actually very crucial. If you look at it, he only confessed to a specific factual predicate, walking two steps away from an officer during a search. What he's challenging here is whether or not the charge of felony evidence tampering by swallowing a controlled substance. He's challenging that, the validity of that charge. Nothing about these two charges. This is basically the easy case. There's no overlap in the factual predicate. And so there's no chance of undermining his conviction of the charge of walking two steps away from an officer.
Is it possible that Mr. Davis has forfeited his fabrication of evidence claim because it wasn't actually pleaded?
No, Your Honor. In these kinds of cases, I think it's important to take a step back and remember what the procedural posture is here. Mr. Davis filed this claim in the IFP in forma pauperis procedure. He filed it pro se. He did ask for counsel below at one point and was denied that counsel. So in these kinds of situations, the Supreme Court in Erickson, this court in Hale, Hitt, Lowry, Olsett, and Ricks encourages the district court and the magistrate judges to really construe these claims broadly, work with the petitioner to see if they have any valid claims. And I do think by the end of the proceedings below, he was addressing directly that he was saying very clearly, the prosecution team, quote, sought out to maliciously prosecute this plaintiff with fabricated evidence, That's ROA 58. He also says police and prosecution fabricated evidence and maliciously prosecuted this plaintiff. So by the end of these proceedings, it should have been very clear to everybody that he was bringing up fabricated evidence.
Okay, and had he raised facts on every element of fabricated evidence?
I think he suggests them all in the case, but that's not what the district court dismissed on. The district court's dismissal was a very narrow reason of these types of claims. It was very specifically on the time limitations. So these are all things that can be addressed on a remand with a new complaint with the benefit of counsel, but it's not the basis for the district court's decision.
Can you point in your complaint where you distinctly plead a standalone fabrication of evidence claim rather than just malicious prosecution, but a standalone fabrication claim?
So again, if you're construing his complaint liberally, as we're supposed to do with pro se complaints, I do think when he very specifically says at ROA 58 that police and prosecution fabricated evidence, I do think that is a standalone claim. He again says it later where he says the prosecution team sought out to maliciously prosecute this plaintiff with fabricated evidence. So he is raising those claims. And also at ROA 16, he very specifically says he's raising Fourth Amendment claims. We don't expect, we don't hold pro se petitioners to quite as high of a standard to be as clear. I do think on the face of this complaint, and by the end of these proceedings, it was very clear that he was making out Fourth Amendment malicious prosecution.
Is your response the same as to the kind of post-indictment release conditions?
Sorry, Your Honor, I'm not understanding the question.
Well, where did you present those as a separate? Did you present those as a separate Fourth Amendment theory in the district court?
In terms of that he, without probable cause, is
right.
That way? I think that is also another claim, and he again broadly alleged Fourth Amendment claims, and I think once you review his factual predicates, these are all the claims that even the district court itself and the magistrate judge at periods identifies. It very specifically identified malicious prosecution. It notes, I think, Fourth Amendment. It notes unjust detention, I believe, at one point. So I think these are all very self-evident on the face of the complaint, especially when we're looking at it from a pro se petitioner's angle. If the court has no further questions, I'm happy to yield the remainder of my time.
You have anything? Thank you very much, Ms. Kiernan.
Thank you, Your Honors.
You've saved time for rebuttal. Mr. Dollahite? Dollahite.
May it please the court, counsel. My colleague, Robert Davis, is going to present the argument on qualified immunity. I'm going to present the argument on Heck and the statute of limitations. If Heck tolling doesn't apply, the statute of limitations bars their claims. If Heck tolling applies, Heck bars their claims. Either way, their claims are barred. The court asked, well, when did these claims first accrue? And originally they sued for unlawful arrest, unlawful detention, excessive force claims. Those claims have now been sort of...
I think they concede those are untimely, don't they?
Right, but I heard her mention a bunch of other constitutional violations that I heard for the first time that somehow relate to his original arrest. And I may have misunderstood what she was saying, but they would likewise have accrued at the time of the arrest and would not be told at all until there was a conviction.
Some sort of seizure and search and 14th Amendment claims, is that what you're talking
Correct.
About?
Correct, yes. That's what she was referring to earlier. Those would have arisen all at the same time as the other original claims would. As to the fabrication of evidence claim, you know, it would have accrued when that fabricated evidence was first used. And I know that in McDonough versus Smith, the Supreme Court case, the plaintiff alleged that the prosecutor used fabricated evidence to get an indictment for election fraud, and the court adopted the Heck principles likewise for the fabricated evidence claim. So, again, if Heck applies, the bar applies. If Heck doesn't apply, the statute of limitations bars the claim. You don't get tolling without the Heck bar. Under Heck, it's no bar, no tolling. The fundamental argument they make, which I think is wrong, is that somehow the charge for the original offense suspended the running of the statute of limitations on all of these claims. And this court and the Supreme Court, those courts have never held that a mere charge suspends and causes the running suspends the tolling of statute of limitations on any claim. It has to be a conviction.
What do you say to the extent that the search and seizure theory is not at the time of the arrest, but is instead conditions of pretrial release, like drug testing and that sort of thing?
That would affect the accrual, but mm-hmm. It wouldn't affect the Heck bar.
Can you talk about the Heck bar in that context of the drug testing and
sure.
possessions of firearms and alcohol and that sort of thing?
Correct. I think the Heck bar two hurdles test would apply in that situation. That was articulated in Sampi versus Rabb. First, the factual basis in Davis's 1983 complaint have to be temporally and conceptually distinct from the factual basis for his conviction for interference with an officer's duties. And if the facts are closely interrelated, the 1983 claim would necessarily imply the invalidity of the arrest and conviction. And second, the second hurdle is the facts alleged in his 1983 complaint must not contradict the facts actually or necessarily adjudicated adversely against him.
How does it contradict in this case, if those are the claims we're talking about?
Because the only reason he's being subject to these requirements is the underlying conviction and guilty plea. The dependency of the criminal case. And so once the conviction occurred, all these pretrial conditions then relate under these two hurdles to his conviction. And so that conviction then under Heck would bar any complaint about those. Again, like fabricated evidence, which they didn't raise in the court below, like fabricated evidence, it's a different accrual date, but the Heck bar is the same either way. Malicious prosecution, the accrual is when he's actually, prosecuted or the cases are dismissed, but even when all the charges are dismissed, like I think it was one of the Supreme Court cases where ultimately he was acquitted. It was the election fraud case. The plaintiff was acquitted of the criminal charge, so there was no pending conviction against him. The court said that the accrual of the statute of limitations on his claim continued, and the fact that he would necessarily implicate the proceedings by virtue of his 1983 action. Let me find that case right quick and I'll give you the specific. McDonough versus Smith, and that was not, I want to correct myself, that was fabricated evidence, but the use of it first occurred during the trial and didn't apply because he was acquitted, and he was acquitted of counting the forged ballots in the election.
Can you address, your friend on the other side said that evidence tampering was discussed in the underlying pleadings at ROA 58. Can you address that?
Don't have it here in front of me. I don't recall it being specifically addressed, but even if it was addressed, the evidence tampering by the officers would not survive the heck two hurdles because of how closely it is related to the factual basis of the criminal proceeding. In the McDonough case I just mentioned that involved the fabricated evidence, the plaintiff argued that the state could have convicted him without using the fabricated evidence, and he could have been convicted without the evidence coming into play, even though he was not, he was acquitted. And the Supreme Court said, well, that sort of theoretical possibility, for example, here, that there was some sort of tainting of the evidence and that impacted his conviction, that still doesn't overcome heck. I mean, the Supreme Court has been, I think, very reluctant to carve out exceptions to the heck bar for dissimilar factual situations, just as this court was in the recent case of Shaw versus Gillen, which I think Justice Wilson was on the panel of, not cited in the briefs, was decided last month. But in that case, the plaintiff was arrested for public intoxication.
So I'm sorry, is that in your brief?
It's not, I apologize.
Did you send it as a 28J?
I didn't have an opportunity to do that. I didn't see it until yesterday.
Did you tell your friend on the other side you're going to bring up a new case today?
I apologize.
Okay. Can have within 3 business days to send a 28J properly identifying the case, and then opposing counsel can have 7 days following to identify any other authority that would rebut that.
Be happy to do that.
Okay, thank you.
It's really just an illustration of the two hurdles test, and that you can't somehow separate aspects of the 1983 complaint from the basic facts of the 1983 case between the conviction and the 1983, when they're based on the same episode, when they're based on the same encounter with the police. The only time this court has allowed that, I think, was that I recall was in Ballard versus Burton, and I'm not sure, I didn't cite it, I'm not sure they cited it, but it has to be a situation where it's so factually separable that it's not going to impact what happened in the case. For example, if the plaintiff is actually complaining, there are two officers involved in the arrest, and only one officer was assaulted and the other was not assaulted, and it happened on a different interaction than the date of the arrest, it was a separate incident, then, you know, heck probably wouldn't apply in that situation because they're separate incidents. They're not so factually interconnected.
But do you believe this was? Do you have, your time has expired, so you need to wrap it up. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Davis.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. Your Honors, I think Mr. Dalhide did a great job on heck and its progeny, so I'll shift into what primarily applies to the defendants that I represent. For the county judge of Smith County, 2 county commissioners of Smith County, the Smith County Sheriff, and the District Attorney, Jacob Putnam. Your Honor, I think it's first most important to point out that there is no underlying constitutional duty to investigate a complaint that somebody brings to you. And I cite a page and a half of citations from this court and from every district in the state of Texas that holds the exact same thing, Your Honor. A county judge also has absolute immunity from being sued, as does a district attorney acting in his prosecutorial function, as do county commissioners acting in their legislative capacity. Your Honor, I'd like to first address the district attorney's specific immunity in this case, and then go on to what I consider to be the simpler claims involving the sheriff, the judge, and the two county commissioners. Like I stated, there is absolutely no duty to independently investigate a claim made by somebody. What the district attorney does is he takes in the evidence that's submitted by various investigative agencies in his jurisdiction. He reviews that information, and if he decides that the information supports taking it to a grand jury for indictment, he can do so. And he did so in this case. And the grand jury indicted this gentleman and also found that there were two underlying charges that also enhanced this, very similar charges based on drug use and drug possession. So the grand jury indicted. This criminal case was around for a while, and ultimately, Your Honors, he accepted a lesser plea. The danger that I see in this case, Your Honor, I think is really extreme, because this is what we're facing. These things all occurred in the exact same criminal episode, okay? The lesser included charges that he was charged with and pled to, admitted to, stipulated to, swore to, was convicted of, and was sentenced for, all involve the exact same instance, the exact same timing of what occurred out there on the side of the road. And what the plaintiff is asking the court to do in this case, Your Honor, is to state that whenever a criminal defendant enters into a plea agreement, admits his culpability, swears to the underlying criminal acts, stipulates to the underlying criminal acts, is convicted of the offense, even if it's a lesser included offense, that he should be able to sue the people that arrested him, the district attorney, the sheriff of the county, all who had no part in this episode, two county commissioners who have no part in this episode. The sheriff, if he wanted to, could not investigate the Tyler Police Department for this alleged civil violation. Neither could the county judge. In his capacity as a judicial officer, he was very nice to meet with this gentleman and talk to him, as were the two commissioners. But they have no power and they have no duty to investigate any of this.
So the district court dismissed this without prejudice, right? Or with prejudice?
Yes, sir.
So should it have been without prejudice? I mean, did the plaintiff get to plead his best case?
Yes, Your Honor, I think so. And looking back over the pleadings, the court told him exactly what he needed to do.
He amended one time, right?
One time, Your Honor.
Okay, but is that enough? I mean, in other words, even if we agree with you that the claims were properly dismissed, should the plaintiff have been able to replead?
Not when any pleading that he could make would be futile, Your Honor. And that really goes into my next point. And so I'm really glad the court raised it at this point, and I might be able to have a little more time to argue it if I can. But amendment in this case is futile against all of my defendants. There's no allegation that the prosecutor did anything outside his absolute judicial immunity. He took the case in, he took it to a grand jury, and he prosecuted it. And Your Honor, from his standpoint, he's an agent of the state. He has an absolute immunity for charging and deciding to charge somebody with a criminal offense. And that's set out very well in Buckley v. Fitzsimmons and Weary v. Fester. It's set out throughout the judiciary process of the Fifth Circuit, and it goes back to English common law. It's not any type of new immunity, Your Honor. The district attorney also, Your Honor, has an absolute immunity for advocacy functions. He can advocate all that he wants. He has an absolute judicial immunity for accepting and sentencing someone to a lesser plea. If prosecutors didn't have that ability, if they did not have the ability to let somebody off who had been convicted previously of criminal offenses, but not in a while, if they don't have that ability, our entire criminal justice system will gum up. So the message here to prosecutors and everybody in law enforcement is charge them with the highest offense, prosecute them for the highest offense, convict them of the highest offense, and never let them get away with an underlying lesser violation, because then you're going to be sued for bringing the higher claim. And that would absolutely destroy our court system. Qualified immunity for the sheriff, the county judge, and the commissioners. I don't know if this man was trying to talk to the county judge in his judicial capacity or his legislative capacity as a county judge. Either way, the judge would be entitled to absolute immunity or qualified immunity for his claims. There's no duty to investigate that the county judge has. The sheriff is the exact same. The sheriff in the state of Texas cannot investigate other law enforcement agencies. That's the role of TCOL and Texas Department of Criminal Justice, Your Honor, under the DPS. None of these individuals had a duty to investigate. None of them should have investigated. None of them have the power to investigate. But most importantly, there's no cause of action for a failure to investigate. His claims have gone so far as to the county judge and the county commissioners. I'm surprised that the federal court judges in Tyler didn't get attempts to visit them, in which case he could have sued them as well. And it's probably also fortunate he doesn't live in New Orleans. Thank you, Your Honors. If any questions, I'll be happy to answer.
I think we have your argument. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Davis. Ms. Kiernan, you've saved time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. Just a few brief points. So as an initial matter, the district court's decision below was very narrow. It held that Mr. Davis's claims were untimely across the board and that there was no favorable determination because of a guilty plea to a different charge. I didn't hear my friends on the other side disagree that the felony evidence tampering charge was dismissed. So that charge under Thompson and Cheverini, that charge is favorably terminated. And that means that his claims didn't accrue for the second reason that you, Judge Elrod, brought up, because his claims that we're still pursuing are all about his post-legal process once he was indicted. So I think it's important to take a step back and remember that Fourth Amendment claims can arise at various points of the proceedings. So yes, he would have had a Fourth Amendment claim, for example, at the time of the arrest when for the night that he spent in jail. We can see that those were untimely and we're not pressing them on appeal. But as Judge Elrod, you pointed out, there were other seizures and searches that occurred once he was indicted. For example, he had to report monthly for drug testing. The record suggests that there was additional nights spent in jail post-indictment.
But what about the idea that those were not favorably terminated?
I didn't actually hear my friend on the other side suggest they weren't favorably terminated. I heard him say that Heck applies because there was a guilty plea to an entirely different charge. So I think that...
Well, but that's how plea agreements work. I mean, in other words, you're going to open up every plea agreement, every guilty plea to count one because we drop count two and three. That prisoner convicted under an agreement can then bring this exact set of claims to counts two and three. I mean, in other words, that just ignores reality of most criminal prosecutions and convictions.
Not at all,
Your Honor.
Doesn't it? Not at all, Your Honor. There are plenty of guardrails in place here that will still protect plea agreements. It's just not the favorable termination element if he wasn't convicted of the charge upon which he's
But again, if they agreed to drop the charge for in exchange for his plea, even if it was a no-lo, I mean, how can you say that's a favorable termination?
Because Thompson was clear, if the charge was dropped and there was no conviction, that's not favorable termination. But again, Heck then comes into play to do a lot of work in the plea agreement process. In the mine run of cases, most of those claims, the ones that are really lesser included, which is the wrong way to be thinking about this, because first off, this isn't a lesser included charge. In the mine run of cases, those lesser included charges are probably going to cause a Heck issue. That's just simply not the case here. I heard that this is going to undermine the factual predicate to which my client pled guilty. Not at all. The only thing he pled guilty to, the only factual predicate, and this is in the record, particularly at Exhibit 6 of our motion for judicial notice, which this court granted, he pled guilty to there with criminal negligence interrupt a peace officer by walking two steps away from the police officer while the officer was performing a duty granted by law. Mr. Davis is challenging the original indictment, which was about whether or not he intentionally and knowingly destroyed and concealed a suspected controlled substance. A jury finding that Mr. Davis did not swallow any cocaine, did not swallow any controlled substance, did not conceal or destroy any controlled substance, will do nothing to undermine the conviction for walking two steps away from an officer. So there's simply no Heck bar here. And again, applying faithfully Thompson to the favorable termination element will not undermine the plea bargaining process. They will still have Heck. It's just not at issue here because this is honestly the very easy case where we have two separate charges. It will, there's also, as you said, Judge Wilson, this is a plea bargain. This is really a contract, how the Fifth Circuit interprets it. Prosecutors can bargain for the right not to have a civil suit going forward. There's also probable cause, as in Chiaverini. There's the causation element, as in Chiaverini. There's multiple guardrails in place here to protect the plea bargaining process. For these reasons, we ask the court reverse the district court's dismissal with prejudice and remand for further proceedings.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
We have your argument. We appreciate all the arguments in this case, and the case is submitted. And we note that Ms. Kiernan is part of the pro bono program, and thank you very much for your service to the court. Thank you.